Hey guys, and welcome to episode 12 of Underrated, a podcast where we look at films we believe are underrated, generally disliked, or simply forgotten. I'm your host, Gabriel Green, and I'm here with my co-host, James Hamrick. How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. I survived election day, so it's all good now.
Yep, me too. Our country, I'm not sure. We'll get back to you on that. All right, so we actually missed last week. I had some crazy stuff going on my end. I totaled my car and spent the whole week looking for a replacement and didn't have time to even touch the podcast, but got a new one, and I think we're back on schedule now, I hope. How was your week, or 2 weeks?
They were pretty normal. This is another test week, so maybe a little bit more stressful than usual, but should be good.
All right, and today is your pick. What are we looking at today?
Today we are going to talk about my personal favorite of the Iron Man trilogy, Iron Man 3. And I'm excited to defend this movie from some of the criticism it gets.
Yeah, I don't agree with you there, but yeah, I do think it's very good. So before we get into that, I'd like to ask you, if you enjoy this podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and rate and review us on iTunes, and also like us on Facebook. That would really help us. And before we get into the main discussion, have you seen any cool movies in the last 2 weeks, James?
So I saw Doctor Strange, which I won't go into now because we plan on recording a mini-sode over that. So other than that, I watched the movie Swiss Army Man.
Okay.
And I honestly had no idea whether I was going to love it or hate it going into it. And whenever it finished, I was still kind of there. I was like, did I love this movie or did I hate this movie? And the more I sat and thought about it, I actually really, really do like this movie. It's definitely not for everybody. Like, it's certainly not a family-friendly movie. It's got, like, just a lot of ridiculously over-the-top adult humor, but it's still, like, really childish. It's funny, though. It's really kind of almost middle school humor, but done in a way like with really good filmmaking. It's just an incredibly odd movie because it has sometimes like beautiful cinematography and a soundtrack that's really, really good. And the two lead performances are actually both really good. And it's kind of about these two guys who become best friends and they like confide in each other and Daniel Rad, but like it's all going on while Daniel Radcliffe's character is like what you initially think is just a corpse that farts and that's it. And then he slowly kind of comes back to life and he gets taught about life by Paul Dano's character as if he's a child. And like Paul Dano confides in him about his, like, it's weird because there's like really great scenes of dialogue and they get really emotional. Like I said, the performance from both actors are amazing, but it's all taking place in the same movie with Daniel Radcliffe farting as a jet ski, like to propel them across the ocean. It's an incredibly absurd movie, and it's one that I'm very hesitant to recommend to people because I don't want them to think that I'm an idiot. And that's kind of a movie where it's like, if I were to tell somebody that I loved that movie and then went out and saw it, they'd be like, James, what is wrong with you? But I don't know. I ended up really enjoying it. So
yeah, the trailers looked very intriguing for that one. I heard a lot of good things. I want to check it out. All right. You see anything else?
That was it for me. What about you?
Well, I watched another Harry Potter film. I reviewed it on the site, but I'm going to save it. Comment on that. I want to do a mini-sode on the whole series. And then I just saw Doctor Strange again, and we're also doing a mini-sode on that. And the only other film I saw was Mean Girls with Lindsay Lohan and Rachel McAdams. And I don't think I'm the target audience for that movie. But as far as like teen comedies go, I think it was fairly enjoyable and clever. It's pretty vapid, but I mean, As I guess I liked it as much as I possibly could have for a film in this genre and for this subject matter. Mm-hmm. So if that's the type of film for you, sure, go check it out. And that's actually all I saw as well. So we can move into our main review of Iron Man 3. Iron Man 3 was released in 2013. It was directed by Shane Black on a budget of $200 million, and it grossed $1.2 billion. So I think you could call this film a resounding success. It's the 10th highest grossing film of all time, and it was the 5th highest grossing when it came out. That's just crazy.
I think, you know, just after the success of the Avengers, people were just waiting for the next one, like, with bated breath.
Yeah, but I'm surprised the backlash didn't hurt it at all, because it was pretty strong and immediate.
Yeah, I wonder how much weight it really had at that time. Like, I feel like a lot of that was probably just canceled out by just everybody still riding the excitement of the Avengers. And, like, this is the third installment of Iron Man. You know, like, everybody at this point, because everybody loved Robert Downey Jr. in the previous two, even though most people didn't even really like Iron Man 2 that much. They still love the character. And I think that might be another thing where it's like, even if people didn't think it was a great movie, like, people are going to go see Robert Downey Jr. as the character. So I think his name just kind of draws people.
Yeah, it's also, I think it's just a very entertaining film. Me and my brother, we actually just sat right through the credits and watched it over again the first time we saw it in the theaters. That's still the only movie I've done that for, but it was just so entertaining. We just looked at each other and said, hey, you want to watch that again? And so, yeah, and, it also stars Robert Downey Jr., Gwyneth Paltrow, Don Cheadle, Guy Pearce, Ben Kingsley, Rebecca Hall, Jon Favreau, and James Badge Dale. It was written by Drew Pearce and Shane Black, and the score was composed by Brian Tyler, who they really need to fire. he's not bad, but he's just boring, I think. Sorry, what was that?
Oh, I actually really enjoyed the music in this movie.
It's just Thor and the Avengers is the only two scores in the entire MCU that is even that stands out from the film that I can listen to anytime, and that is actually like a really recognizable theme. I think I don't know if it's the composers they're hiring or the fact that Marvel wants fairly tame scores is strange, because they had even Doctor Strange had Michael Giacchino. And that wasn't as good as his usual work.
Yeah, I remember getting excited about seeing his name attached to Doctor Strange, and like, you can hear hints of where that movie almost had a really great score.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
I'm not sure.
And this is your pick, James, so I'll let you start out with the conversation. What do you like about this movie?
So, one of the first things... actually, pretty much the first thing that I think about when I think about this movie is just its tone. And it's really weird to describe it. Although, you know, so Shane Black wrote, you know, Lethal Weapon 1 and 2. And I think you mentioned it before we even started recording. You know, it has that 90s action kind of buddy cop feel. Even it's not a buddy cop story, but it kind of has that really energetic, just really entertaining kind of feel to it. And there's something about that that I just really, really liked. And I think one of the things that I liked about it was, like, quips and one-liners are right at home in a 90s action movie. Like, that's where they make sense. And so usually, even though almost all of the Marvel movies make me laugh, whenever I sit down and, like, think about like a pros and cons, I usually end up putting humor under the cons, because I think a lot of the time it feels forced. I mean, I'll put it in pros as well, because like I said, I do end up laughing and enjoying most of it, but sometimes it just kind of feels out of place, like it's kind of part of that Marvel formula, so you just have to inject it here. And I think here it doesn't feel forced, and it doesn't feel like, oh well, they just had to do this because this is part of their template that they use. It felt right at home with the tone that this movie was. And I just found it to be also just one of the funniest. Like, the lines that were in it were some of the funnier ones. And because it's primarily just Robert Downey Jr. delivering them, it always feels right whenever he says a one-liner. He's the one character who should always be quipping. Sometimes I think they make certain characters who shouldn't really be quipping all the time do it just to be funny, but with him carrying the movie, it made sense.
Yeah, actually, rewatching it this time, after having seen several other Shane Black directed or written films, it really struck me how much of a Shane Black or even 90s action movie this is. I mean, you have the high-level corporate corruption. Like, it's very mysterious. Like, you never get a lot of information about it, but there's some kind of corruption going on. And then our pair of heroes have to go out on this some kind of road trip to find out the truth. And then there's always a scene where bad guys come in with, like, huge, overwhelming firepower and just blow something up. That happens in all of these movies. And, oh yeah, and it's Christmas. So that's a Shane Black staple. So it feels, in both in style and structure, very similar to the popular action films of the 90s, a lot of which were written by Shane Black. I think that is both a positive and a partial negative for this film. I think as a 90 action film is mostly successful. I'm going to get into this a bit more later on, but I'm not sure how well this works as an MCU film. So, but it is definitely very, very enjoyable as a 90s action film with Iron Man in it.
I think with it feeling like a 90s action film, it almost takes me back to whenever the cartoon hero shows are like at their peak. You know, you have the 90s Spider-Man, the 90s Batman. And maybe it is like this movie just really played on nostalgia for me. Like, it felt like that just super energetic, fun kind of superhero feel that I had like grown up with all of those movies and cartoons and shows that mm-hmm. I was watching.
Yeah, and I'm definitely a big Shane Black fan, and so that definitely made it a bit more enjoyable. And I think for me the strongest aspect of this film is the character of Tony Stark in here. I think he gets a really solid arc, and I think it's probably one of the better character arcs in the MCU. It follows directly after the events of the Avengers, and I think the results also play into the next two films. So I think he and Robert Downey Jr. is a fantastic actor, so I think he plays the entire PTSD thing very well. I just like how for the previous two films, he's been able to keep this shell around him. He just always plays the confident know-it-all and keeps his defenses up. And here we see that all stripped away. His entire sense of security and being has been challenged by the fact that there's aliens and wormholes and all kinds of crazy stuff. And so now he's making all these suits in this desperate attempt to protect himself and what he loves. And then this movie, it just slowly strips all that away from him and just leaves him with just himself and his intellect. And he has to essentially find himself in all the chaos. And I think it's a really solid arc. It's played out very well by Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, that's definitely something I had listed for me as well. I think that I actually enjoy Iron Man 2, I feel like, more than most.
Yeah.
But something that I didn't like about that movie was the fact that, you know, in the comics, he has an issue with alcoholism. Like, he is an alcoholic, essentially, and there's some stories that really dive into it, and they were kind of hinting that they go the demon in a bottle route with Iron Man 2, and they were going to kind of push his character further, and what we essentially got was just a stupid party scene that just ended up, like, the only significant thing to come out of that was it's whenever Rhodey was able to leave and become War Machine, essentially. But, like, other than that, I don't feel like he really developed as a character in that movie. He finishes Iron Man 2 essentially exactly where he was at the end of Iron Man 1. Whereas in this one, like you said, this is way more personal. It means a lot more to him. Like, I find this movie to be, while it's the funniest of the three, I also find it to be the darkest and the most personal to Tony of the mm-hmm. three. And then, like you said, just watching him kind of come to terms with the world and the way it was now. Because at one point, you know, him being Iron Man was the thing. He was the craziest thing out there. And now this guy who's so egocentric is having to realize that he's having a hard time processing what he's been through. And so to see him cover it up with humor, it's funny, but it's also just really, really good character development. And then, like you said, it's really, it's it's sold completely to us by Robert Downey Jr.'s amazing performance. And I think that apart from Civil War, this is the best performance he's given in the MCU.
Yeah, and one thing that's really fascinated me is how in the previous three films, I guess, he's always in perfect control of his surroundings, and his quips he uses his humor and quips to basically keep everybody else in their place. But in the last three films, especially in this one, his humor feels a lot darker and more desperate, and it's often fairly cruel to the people around him sometimes. And it's very funny, but it's a very different tone. It's like he's desperately trying to gain control through the humor, but the cracks are showing. I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, he's kind of using it almost as a defense mechanism in this one, whereas it's always been him kind of on the attack before. You know, like when he's quipping to Loki, he's kind of using that to display his confidence in their situation, whereas, like you said, it's kind of frantically trying to feel like he's still in charge, and it does come more at the expense of those he's joking about in this movie. One of the other positives that I really liked about this movie, and it's kind of in relation to the humor, is this movie has a sidekick that I think actually works.
Which one? There's two of them.
The kid.
The kid? Isn't...
And I usually do not like any movie that feels like it has the force a kid into a genre, like into a movie series where they really don't belong. This happens so much where, like, as a movie series drags on for whatever reason, even though it's just, I feel like, been proven to not make a movie successful, they just throw a kid in there and it ruins the dynamic. But that doesn't happen in this movie. One, I think because, like, Ty Simpkins is, you know, he's acted, especially at this point, he's acted in several movies and he can actually hold his own to a certain extent with some of the other actors. I just think he and Robert Downey Jr. had really good chemistry together.
Yeah.
The way they joked was really funny. He never did the annoying kid thing where he's like, he's getting himself into situations and the hero's having to rescue. Even though Iron Man, well, he doesn't even really rescue him. He just gives him the tool to essentially rescue himself. So he's never an annoying obstacle that the film has to get over. He's just a really fun companion to the main story.
Yeah, and he's not just a complete idiot. He's fairly capable, and I think most importantly, the film leaves him behind after a little while. So he's not. I think it would have been horrible if they had dragged him along to the climax or something. I think the film knows when to use him and when to just kind of phase him out of the story. And I think that's where this film succeeded and a lot of other kid sidekick films failed. But yeah, Ty Simpkins, he's pretty great. I think him and Robert Downey Jr. had a great chemistry, and I think he could hold his own in some of the quipping scenes. Even though Tony's a horrible person.
Yeah,
the way he treats his kid is just awful throughout the film, which it's hilarious too.
I remember seeing it in the theater for the first time, and I'm not sure if it's my favorite. It's in the running for my favorite line of the movie. Whenever he's in the car and he's like, you know how I can tell? Because we're connected. And he just drives off. And then so I laughed like everybody else in the audience. And then I thought to myself, like, I just laughed about a guy driving away from this kid who has no father and leaving him in the snow. Like, it's such a dark scene when you really think about it. But just because the writing was really good in this movie, it just worked. And I love all of the really, really dark humor in this movie.
Yeah, it's messed up, but it's hilarious. That scene is also, I think, one of the funniest in the series. And I think Shane Black is a fairly solid action director. I think all of the action scenes in this film, there's no shaky cam, and I think the cameras pull back far enough. One issue I have is I think the CGI is a bit too apparent here and there, and that does make it feel a bit weightless sometimes, but it's always really good looking. The action always looks great. You can tell what's going on. And I think it's also fairly creative. There's a lot of creative things going on, especially the two scenes, the one where I'm going to call spoilers now. Just if you haven't seen the film, why haven't you? Go see it. It's awesome. So if you haven't seen the film, go watch it, because we're going to spoil some things that happen towards the end. Like when he goes and breaks into Killian's mansion, and where he's using all his homemade tools and weapons. That's just a really fun, creative scene. And then the next scene where he's escaping, and he only has the boot and the glove, and he's flying around trying to take all these guys out with machine guns. It's a lot of crazy camera work, but it's very fun. And you can tell what's going on. And that's a problem I have with some other Marvel films, and in the upcoming review for Doctor Strange, I'll mention it. But I think Shane Black knows how to make an action scene energetic without blurring what's going on the screen.
Yeah, I was, because I had listed the action as a positive here as well, and I was trying to think of some of the action scenes that I wanted to highlight, and I think there's some really good things in every single action scene in this. Like the opening attack on his mansion. It's just a really cool scene. Like I just kind of get tired of slow-mo being overused, but like as it's all kind of crumbling and the suit goes and starts trying to attach itself and then it attaches to Pepper instead. It was just like a lot of really cool shots in that scene. And then the one you mentioned, I love it whenever he breaks into the mansion with almost like a MacGyver tool set, essentially. and like the other scene with just the single boot and he's just spinning around in the air with an Uzi. It's just really like a lot of good comedic beats in the action scene. And then I just love the finale of that movie. That final action scene, to me, there's some of like just the most creative, different kind of not really spectacles going on or set pieces, but just a lot of different cool shots. There's like a bunch of different fight scenes happening in the one main fight, and it's essentially just a series of going from this Iron Man suit and watching him fight these guys, and then going over to this Iron Man suit and watching him. And I mean, you know, there's really only one or two heroes with a Rhodey being there of that scene. And so it doesn't feel like there's as much at stake as others do, because most of what's fighting is just lifeless Iron Man suits. But I couldn't help but just have fun, like, and sit down and watch all of these different suits and the different ways they work, fight. And then, you know, I'm becoming more of a fan of the comic books, and so I started reading about the movie after it came out, and every single one of those suits that's used in that fight scene has been used in the comics. And so it's just, I'm sure the people who are diehard Iron Man fans, unless they left the theater because of the Mandarin, the ones who stayed around to watch the finale were probably just so excited as they see all these different incarnations of the suit fighting the way they fought in the comics. Is just really entertaining. And I think, obviously not as grand of a fight scene as the Avengers, but it really couldn't be. To me, it's a perfect finale to a standalone superhero movie post-Avengers.
Yeah, I really like that finale, with a minor caveat that I love the character of Rhodes, but some of the things he does here are just plain stupid from a physics perspective. And also, just like where he's on the crate and he shoots the wire and swings over, jumps on the president, then swings over again. It's really ridiculous, I think. And the film has been fairly grounded up till then, and then it just kind of throws out physics, and it I think it stands out. And also, Tony crashes into a lot of big metal objects with only partial suits quite a few times. He would have been completely pulverized about a dozen times in that battle alone. I mean, you don't get to smash into metal while wearing a heavy metal suit and have an arm sticking out and not have it completely broken in 20 different places. So scenes like that took me out, but it's still a really fun, very creative action scene.
I think that at that point, I was just so used to seeing Tony do things that should get somebody killed after his plummet from the sky in Iron Man 1 when he...
But at least he's been wearing armor and all the other things. Now he's doing that without armor.
The one that got me the most in Iron Man 1 was whenever he first tries on his boots and it just throws him into the wall. And I can't help but think your ribs, at least one rib is broken right now.
Yeah.
But
yeah, but that's a minor nitpick. It's a sci-fi action film. And the humor you mentioned before, that's for me, that's both a positive and a slight negative. I think I actually thought it did at times take away from the seriousness. Like when the Rhodey and him are infiltrating the shipyard, it could have been a tense scene, but the entire thing is kind of played as a joke. So there's no tension. There's never really any tension throughout this film. Well, there is some, but not where you need it. In a scene like that. And I think it just undermines some of the drama and connection we could have to these characters going through these dangerous circumstances if it's all played for humor. And I laughed at all of it. I think it's funny. I just think it does hurt the film a little bit from a dramatic standpoint if you constantly undermine every serious thing with a joke. And that's an issue action films in general have nowadays. And it's not a huge problem. It's just a slight issue.
For me, I didn't get it so much from that scene. I don't think that they were necessarily trying to be super dramatic with that one. And I think one of the reasons that I love the beginning of that scene is that's where it actually does kind of start to feel like that buddy cop kind of 90s tone. And that's another one of the lines that's always, I think of as maybe one of my favorites, where he goes and he tries to see where he is. And he's like, where is he? He's like, couldn't see too quick. Like... There's just so many like really funny lines with really good delivery. And I definitely see what you're saying where, you know, oftentimes, you know, humor will come at the expense of drama. But for whatever reason, I never really got that from this one. I think Shane Black kind of knew the tone and just because of his experience with 90s movies. And maybe it's just because I can acknowledge that a lot of 90s movies aren't great, but I just love the 90s action genre. And so I was just enjoying all of the references, everything that felt right at home. I was like, okay, this is good. I can't list this as a negative.
Yeah, I definitely don't begrudge you that. It is funny.
And then, so obviously, like for a movie to work that has good action, you have to have like good villains in it. And this is what I'm going to list as a positive that I know is like, this is the controversy of the whole movie. I feel like, you know, reading through the reviews, you had people saying, you know, oh, some of the humor was forced, some of this was this, you know, but really at the heart of most of the negative reviews, at least from comic book fans, it was about Mandarin. And whenever I first saw Iron Man 3, I had very little knowledge of the Mandarin. I knew him by name, and I knew that he was the guy with, like, the Fu Manchu. Like, that's what I knew about Mandarin. And because of that, I think I was able to watch this movie and see that twist and not get wholly offended. Because, if I saw a Batman movie and the Joker was nothing more than just an actor hired by someone else, I would lose it. So I'm not even going to try to convince people to not be mad about it, because if they did this to a character that I loved, I'd be mad. But because I'm not super attached to him, I wanted to like stand up and clap just that they had the boldness to do this to such a huge character. And I think that's one of the reasons that Iron Man 3 is just such a standout in the MCU to me, is because even a lot of people... like myself, I never want to sound like I don't like the MCU. I absolutely love the MCU. But you can kind of see the formula show itself after movies. And I think the fact that this movie didn't have probably as much action as the others did, and it stripped Iron Man of his suit for a good bit of the movie, and then it completely flipped what you thought you knew about the villain on its head. It just did so much to make it stand out. And so I love the twist. I loved whenever Ben Kingsley walks in with his British accent and makes a joke about the fact that he just left the bathroom and it stinks. Now, it took me a bit. I'm sure, like everyone else in the audience, my jaw dropped. Like, what? The ads made this guy look like he was going to be one of like the greatest, most serious, dramatic villains. Because I was excited about his performance, but for a completely different reason whenever I saw the trailers. You know, I was like, man, this seems like a terrorist, the comic book villain terrorist played by Ben Kingsley, who sounds the way he does in these trailers. This is going to be insane. And then he's just like a drugged up, hapless British actor. It's such a big twist, but I just ended up really enjoying the role. And it seemed like Ben Kingsley loved playing the role.
Yeah, I love that. Well, actually, I'll wait to get my issues with that out of the way at the end. But as far as Ben Kingsley, he's incredible because he gives two fantastic, completely polar opposite performances in this film. If you go watch the trailers for this movie, they're fantastic. They sell a very dark, serious movie that's going to like take the hero to his darkest point, and this villain is going to tear him apart. And they sell that movie really well. We don't get that movie. I would love to have seen that version of the movie, but I think the reveal of what he actually is brilliantly done. Ben Kingsley is hysterically funny. And the only issue I have with that is I don't like Killian. So when you make him not the main villain, you have Killian as the main villain, it does hurt the film a little bit. I'll get into that later. But yeah, as far as Ben Kingsley and as far as how that scene is played, it's brilliant. And also, they actually did make, in the one shot, the Marvel one shot they released later on, written and directed by one of the writers, Drew Pierce, they actually kind of go back and say, actually, you know, he wasn't the real Mandarin. The real Mandarin is still out there. And so I guess they did that to kind of make the comic boy fanboys happy. So you can take it or leave it. But,
yeah, that's probably my favorite of the one shots. Just, I don't know, it felt very much like Iron Man 3. And then probably just because we got to see Ben Kingsley again. I'm hoping it's not just kind of, hey, he's still out there, all right, let's move on. I'm hoping that they're actually setting up, because I would also like to see the actual real Mandarin. But I have a feeling it's just to try to make some of the Iron Man fans less angry at Iron Man 3. But yeah, I love everything about his performance. Like you said, it's two polar opposite performances, both played to perfection by the same actor in the same movie. I love the way they reveal it. The fact that it's not this big moment. The music isn't cueing you in to know that something huge is about to happen. He just walks out of the bathroom and starts talking, and like,
yeah,
you just go with it. So, yeah, obviously this is the point that a lot of people will probably disagree with me on, but as a fan of just superhero movies and directors taking risks with them instead of just kind of sticking to a template, like, I loved everything that they did with this character. And then with Killian, I mean, he's certainly not, you know, on the level of some of the greater comic book villains. He's no Loki, and he's not Mandarin either, because I love Mandarin. But I feel like Guy Pearce is able to make him, even if only slightly, better than most of the comic book villains that movies have in them. Like, because we've kind of seen it before. He's essentially the character, I'm forgetting his name, from The Incredibles, who starts out as a huge fan and he becomes the villain in the second half of the
Syndrome.
Movie. Who is it?
Syndrome,
that's right. And so, I mean, it's something that's been done before, but I'm just a really big fan of Guy Pearce. And then seeing him like breathe fire and do all sorts of ridiculous stuff, I think that's another thing that kind of shows up in this movie, is both Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2 felt more grounded because they were still building up to it. But then whenever, you know, there's alien portals in the sky in Avengers and giant space worms flying around, I feel like this movie was like, okay, so we're given a little bit more leeway with what we can do. So they had Killian open his mouth and just breathe fire. And I'm forgetting the names of the actors, or of the actor and actress who played like the two henchmen.
James Badge Dale and Stephanie Zosak, I believe.
Zosak, that's right. Neither of them are in the movie a whole lot, but I think they do pretty much the best you could do with those roles. Like, the sequences that they're in are both done really well. Her chase through the streets with him, and he's dodging the fire, and then she ends up, you know, getting blown up and hung in the power lines, and then the other guy chasing him around and pulling down the water tower on him. they could have just been, you know, oh, this is just henchman number one and number two. But I feel like the actors were able to give personality to the henchmen, and then the action scenes mm-hmm. themselves were better than, I guess, your standard fair comic book movie. So I kind of like both lead, or I really loved one villain. I liked the other one, the main one that we ended up getting. And then the henchmen were, I think, above average as well. So for the most part, like, I think the villains of this movie is definitely a plus.
Yeah, I had James Badgedale as, like, Savin. It's weird. He has this really great just swagger and, like, he couldn't care less about what's happening attitude. And I think that's really fun for a henchman. And just briefly about Ben Kingsley again, I think that's probably the only comedic role I've seen him in. And seeing that makes me really wish he did a lot more comedies. And as the Mandarin, there's one scene where he hacks into the president's phone and tells him to call him or he's going to execute somebody. And then after he does it, he has this really chilling monologue about how he's going to come and kill the president. And that scene is terrifying. Ben Kingsley is incredible. That's all. That's all I have to say about him. And as far as the cast of side characters, I like Gwyneth Paltrow. She's always fun. She gets along really well with Robert Downey Jr. as Pepper Potts. I think they have a really cool dynamic. I'm not sure the film exactly knew what to do with her, and I'll get into that later. But Rhodes, he's always fun. I still miss Terrence Howard. I would have liked to have seen what he could have done with the role. But Don Cheadle does really great as well, so I really can't complain.
I really do like Terrence Howard a lot, but just comparing the two, obviously we have a lot more to compare with Don Cheadle now. Mm-hmm. But I think the friendship and the kind of back and forth works better with Don Cheadle. I think he has has better comedic timing, in my opinion, at least from what I've seen from Terrence Howard. And I love him as an actor. He's got a great range. He can be super serious and dramatic in some movies and then just be able to fire out the quips with the best of them in others. So having him in a movie is always a plus for me.
They do play the characters very differently, but I really love what Terrence Howard did as well. I think he had really good comedic timing with Robert Downey Jr. as well. So, but we'll never know.
So the last positive that I had mentioned was, and I guess this is, just found out, this will be one we kind of disagree on, is I actually did like the music in this movie. Iron Man 1, kind of, it has like one good theme that plays whenever he first flies, and then they never use it again. And Iron Man 2 is, I don't remember anything about it. The only memorable musical piece from Incredible Hulk, because whenever they pull back the theme from the TV show. And then, like you said, really Avengers and Thor are kind of the only movies that have had memorable themes. And while I don't think Iron Man 3 has like a super memorable theme, I think what the composer, I'm forgetting his name, I had notes, but my computer deleted everything.
It's Brian Tyler.
Brian Tyler. I think what he did well in this movie is just kind of help accentuate certain scenes. The scene that kind of sticks out in particular for me is whenever Happy goes and he confronts the henchman at the Chinese Ramen Theater. It's got that old school kind of, anytime anybody like throws a punch, the music just kind of is loud out of nowhere. And it's like matching the physicality of them. And then as he emerges through the rubble, the music comes up with him. And it's almost, it reminds me of like in the comics, whenever someone punches something, like you have the bubble that says wham. That's what the music felt like in this to me, is it was accentuating all of the action. And then the theme that does play as Iron Man kind of makes his hero appearances in certain scenes. I mean, it's not, you know, John Williams Superman by any means, but I think it's pretty decent in comparison to a lot of other superhero movies that feel like they almost have no theme from start to finish.
Yeah, it's not that I think the theme is bad or the music is bad. It's just that they've had Brian Tyler on to do about four different Marvel films. And in general, I think the music is fairly indistinguishable one from the other. I think it fits the movie fine, but there's never really a recognizable theme. And I think superhero movies are kind of a perfect playground for a composer because they can create a distinct theme. And I'm not sure if it's his fault. Maybe he's just with the wrong director or something. But I've never really been impressed with his scores that much. So yeah, it's not a huge complaint. It's just I don't think it's a huge complaint to say that I didn't notice the score. That's kind of the job of the score. But when I have seen scores that I can listen to outside the film, it is a little disappointing with one I really have no interest in returning to. All right, I'm about ready to transition into dislikes. Do you have any positives you want to get out of the way before that?
Oh, that was actually the last thing I had listed here to mention. So I'm ready to talk about the small handful of things that I'm actually not a fan of in this movie.
All right. For me, I don't think the plot and villain make much sense at all. I don't think they really connect with Tony's story. Tony's story is like completely internal. It's about him battling his own demons. And while these villains, they fight him, they're not really at all connected to his own struggle and like what he wants, what he's trying to do. So, and that isn't necessary, but I think thematically it would have helped if they had somehow been some kind of demon from it. Well, there's supposed to be like something from his past, but that doesn't even connect that much either. So I think if they could have connected the main conflict with his internal conflict, it would have been a bit more interesting. And as a whole, I love the Mandarin, but I could not care less about Aldrich Killian. I couldn't care less about him. I don't know why he's bad. I don't know what he wants, besides power and money, I guess. And even that, the way he goes about it isn't the best way to get that. So it seems he's just bad for bad's sake, and he likes being bad. But I don't know why, I don't know what he wants, I don't know why he's bad. So I think Guy Pearce is fine in the role, he's not bad. But I don't think he gives it enough personality to make it all that memorable. And he's just kind of there, and he's defeated, and I don't care. And that does mar a film in a way. And as far as the plot, what did he want? Because at first he seems he wants to kill Tony. But then when he captures him, he wants Tony to work for him. What he wants. And then there's Maya Hansen, played by Rebecca Hall, who is also quite good. But I don't even know why she's in the movie. Just how their stories interact between Guy Pearce and Rebecca Hall and Tony is really convoluted. Because she goes to his, I don't know, why does she go to his house, first of all, when it blows up? Why does she take Pepper to a hotel? Because she's surprised when Killian shows up. And then why does she turn good all of a sudden? None of those things feel connected or in any way consistent with whatever character she's supposed to have, because I don't know who she is or what she wants. And then she's killed and the film completely forgets about her. And I think her entire character probably should have been cut out of the film because she doesn't do anything of importance. I just don't think he's all that interesting of a villain. And when you have a character like Tony, he completely overshadows him and he's forgotten as soon as the movie's over for me.
So, I definitely agree with a few of your points there. With Rebecca Hall's character, I feel like I followed the movie. I followed her motivations. I think everything that her character did, like, it somewhat made sense. I just feel like it was really, really underdeveloped. Like, I understand that her mission was to get Tony to help them finish whatever they need with Extremis, because, you know, evidently they still haven't worked out the kinks and everything yet, so they needed his mind, I guess is what the beginning of the movie established for us with the scene and them talking about it. And then, you know, whenever Aldrich shows up and she was surprised by him, I think it was just kind of stated that their timetable was moving ahead and so he had to find her early. And then I mean, I guess I understand why she's good. You know, she grew a conscience or whatever. Couldn't stand to see Tony die. She didn't feel like she could let herself do that. I kind of understand everything that she's doing, and I can follow her story arc. I just feel like it's a character that we haven't been introduced to prior to this movie. This movie hasn't really done a lot to try to get us to care about the character prior to her death, so that when she does die, it feels like nothing. We're like, oh, well, I mean, yeah, she had like a total of 4 or 5 scenes before this, and she
played a different character in each of them.
Yeah, and so it just it was really, to me, her character is absolutely the weakest link of the movie, and it has nothing to do with Rebecca Hall. It just has everything to do with, yeah, she plays all of her scenes, you know, really well. Her comedic lines she delivers really well. It's just the character was really underwritten. And like you said, I think it's just kind of unnecessary, because it seems like had Pepper not been in the story, you know, she would have been the love interest, you know, and then he would have been betrayed. But then it's like they remembered, oh, wait, we already have Pepper as a love interest. So this is she'll be a prior love interest, I guess. We just need her. It felt like, I mean, I guess like we both said, just unnecessary. There was no reason to have her in the film. There was no reason to bring in a prior romantic relationship of Tony, especially if we're not really going to care about her that much, and then you're going to kill her off anyways. Just really doesn't make sense with the script. About the villain's motivations, this is actually something that I forgot to mention in the positives. I actually kind of thought it was, you know, not super original, but the idea of kind of having both the president and essentially this Marvel's version of Osama bin Laden in the Mandarin, having both of them as your puppets and supply and demand, I thought it was kind of an interesting take. Like he's in, you know, experimental military whatever, and so he stands to gain profit from ongoing conflict, and so to essentially own both sides of the war on terror is obviously to his benefit. So the idea that he owns the president, and he owns the president's enemy, and he's orchestrating this huge war, or what would have been this big conflict, I think it's, even though it's not really explored a lot in the movie, there's only a couple of scenes that actually spell out what it is, mainly when he's talking to Colonel Rhodes whenever he's in the suit and he's trying to get him out. So even though it's kind of underdeveloped, the idea is kind of cool to me. The idea that he has both sides of a conflict and he's just profiting off of the fact that it exists.
That would be interesting if he wasn't a fire-breathing psychopath who doesn't seem to care about it. Like whenever he's on screen, it seems like he couldn't care less about anything. And we're told that he wants money. But it doesn't match up with the character we see on screen, I think, is my issue.
Or
what?
Or it's made better by the fact that he's a fire-breathing psychopath.
Either way. But about the psychopath part, is there something in Extremis that makes everybody a psychopath when they take it? Except Pepper? Because there's a whole bunch of veterans who are previously disabled, and they all seem to really enjoy killing now. It's really weird.
Yes. So I think that was probably something, and obviously this is pure speculation, but I feel like Extremis probably had more in the story, in the original script.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that was an idea that they were exploring, the idea that it would mess with your head. Because, I mean, you do kind of see somewhat like mental degradation. Maybe not mental degradation, but he seems to be getting crazier as the movie goes on.
Yeah.
Especially towards the end when he's screaming, "I am the Mandarin." Like,
I said, I would be kind of mad if I looked like him right then too.
Yeah, well, that is true. But yeah, I think, and I haven't actually read the comic book that this is based off of, but also wouldn't surprise me if in the comics Extremis kind of made you more aggressive and more violent. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if that was something that was going to be in the movie, and then just for whatever reason, it kind of was less and less involved in the script. But yeah, I noticed that as well. Everybody who's taking this seems to really just want to go out and cause a lot of destruction and mayhem. And then so, for a couple of my other own dislikes, the only other two that I have both have to do with the ending. And so if you're wanting to talk about some of yours before I finish, is there anything else that you aren't really a fan of?
Yeah, there's a couple minor nitpicks. But doesn't Tony have some kind of contingency plan to protect Pepper if everything goes to hell? I mean, does she really have to seriously go bunk up with Maya? Like, she has absolutely nowhere to go if he's gone. It would seem like he would have, since the film sets up, he is trying to build all these suits to protect her, and he's always the guy with a million contingency plans, that he would have something set up to take care of her if something like this happened. And she's just left on the side of the road and has to go share a hotel with Maya Hansen. It just feels weird. Like, why is this happening? Why is she going with her?
I think that the events of this movie happened so quickly that there may very well have been one. It's just everything was happening so fast. It wasn't allowed to happen long enough for us to see if maybe there was one. And I guess the reason she went off with Maya was because, I mean, she was there. Clearly she knows something about the past and what's going on in regards to what Tony's doing right now. So, you know, I guess might as well go with her.
Yeah, she's also a billionaire CEO. Doesn't she have anything of her own too? I mean,
that's true. Know.
Is Happy her only bodyguard? I don't know. Okay. That's like a minor nitpick. And where's it going? I have one more. And I guess this is a problem with a lot of them, but why don't they call anybody? I mean, seriously, they have the president kidnapped. Couldn't they at least call the National Guard or some kind of cavalry to come in there? I mean, do they really have to go rescue the president with two people? You're on American soil. I mean, he and Rhodes is a soldier. Why would he call the vice president, first of all? The vice president is a figurehead. Why would he call some kind of military leader? It is just, I know a lot of these superhero films have that problem when you have a solo film. You're like, why didn't they call the Avengers? But in this case, they could have just called the U.S. Army as well.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's just kind of, I mean, you kind of talked about it. You know, a lot of these movies are having that issue where it's in a real world scenario, we wouldn't really need Iron Man to take care of something. Like, we would have our own way of doing something, but I guess just for the sake of a movie, it had to be Iron Man and War Machine. But
and why did they leave Rhodey alive? I mean, seriously. You just leave a special operative unconscious in your house and just leave him there. I mean, why didn't they kill him? They seem to enjoy killing people a lot, but they just leave him alive. It seems, it's just, that right there really sticks out as kind of a movie logic moment where there's absolutely no reason for any of this to happen, but it happens because of script. And that just really took me out of the movie. I mean, most of those are minor, except for the villain part. What was your last dislike?
So, my last dislikes, they're two, and they're both related to the ending of the movie. One of them is more minor. The other one is, I wouldn't even call the other one really major, but it bothers me a little bit. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth somewhat for the movie. So with the first one, I was just not on board with Pepper coming out and like saving the day at the very end. Like, ooh, I have extremis now. Now I can do this cool backflip and catch this guy out of the air. I don't know. I think it was kind of what you said. They didn't really know what to do with Pepper in the movie. And they're like, let's make her have a cool action scene. It's like, there's really no reason to. And I don't know. Iron Man has already not been in his suit for most of the movie, which I'm okay with. Like, the idea that they strip him of his technology and his suits for a good portion of the movie is fine. I think it does a lot for the character. But I want Iron Man to, like, do the last cool thing in the movie. And so to just...
Yeah, he does. Like, if he had... If the Mark 42 latching on to Killian and blowing up, that would have been an awesome finale, I think. I think after that, it feels kind of unnecessary.
Yeah. It was kind of overkill. And I
seriously.
And I feel like that was a moment that the screenwriters probably thought, man, everybody's going to cheer when this happens. But really, it's like, we thought he died already. And it was kind of a cool death. And it referenced something that happened at the beginning of the movie. It was perfectly fine. And then we just had her jump out. And then I forget what his line is exactly, but the line that he has to, like, for her right after that scene was one of the few lines of dialogue, like comedic lines of the dialogue, that I felt like, eh, that was kind of forced.
I got nothing with the sports bra part.
Something about, oh wait, I think it may have been her, whoever said the, who's the piping hot mess or something like that.
That one?
It just felt kind of, I don't know, forced. Like, we had a cool moment. Time to have a funny line about that cool moment. I don't know. It felt unneeded. The other one,
Shane Black,
to me, was him blowing up all of his suits. I kind of get what it means thematically. Like, oh, he's letting go of his obsession. He's kind of somewhat beating his anxiety and PTSD, I guess, over the events of the Avengers. But one, just as a fan, especially after seeing all those cool suits, like, I get it. I get you wanting to make a statement to your girlfriend that, look, I'm going to pay more attention. But I, as an Iron Man fan, don't want to just see you blow up all your cool suits, for one. Like, we're supposed to be cheering.
They looked cool, though.
They look way cooler when they're not blown up, though. Anybody can make fireworks. So just, like, having the end, just how all of these suits blow up as a gesture of him moving on. And then this isn't really undermine, the movie doesn't undermine itself, but it's undermined with Age of Ultron, because then we just see he still has all of his suits. We kind of saw a prototype Hulkbuster in Iron Man 3, and then we see the actual Hulkbuster in Age of Ultron, and he's got, I think we see multiple suits in that as well. And so it's like, look, I blew up all my suits. Okay, I'm going to go make some more now. Like, any symbolism, I feel like, that was meant to be given to us through that ending sequence kind of loses impact, considering we know Iron Man's still going to be in multiple suits going forward. So, I don't know. It didn't really work for me. I get what it meant for that specific movie, but I don't think it really works well in the grand scheme of things. And then just as a comic book fan, I'm like, I'm not cheering for fireworks whenever it comes at the expense of, like, the coolest, these suits that made one of the coolest sequences of the movie.
Yeah, I like what it means thematically for his character. And I actually do think the later films carry on the character arc pretty well, where now he's fixed himself, now he's trying to fix the world. Like, after this, you really don't have the deep, so, like, soul-searching anxiety. You do in a different way after he messes up the world, too. But I think he's fixed his character anxiety and his insecurities. So I think him going from that perspective to now he's trying to fix the world, I think that's a natural progression for his character. I just don't think blowing up the suits is the best way to show it. Removing the arc reactor might have done that. Just been the kind of the thematic thing. He's moving on. He doesn't need this anymore. He doesn't need all this other stuff anymore to save him. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how you would show that visually. And I think it's a nice sequence. It's a sweet moment between him and Pepper. But as you said, it doesn't mean squat. for as far as blowing up his suits means nothing, because he's just going to go back and build more. Even walking out of the theater after Iron Man 3 in 2012, you know that's going to happen. Because a bunch more movies coming. So yeah, it's a nice moment, but I think they could have found a better way to visually represent the change of heart he has.
I feel like just pulling out the shrapnel could have, like, it, since that's in the movie, to me that was enough to visually see the theme that they're trying to convey. Mm-hmm. Like, that idea that, look, I'm not going to let this haunt me anymore. This thing that could have been my death that set me off on this. It doesn't control me anymore. I got it out. Like, that's enough for me. There's no real reason to do this, especially since, you know, physically, it means nothing going forward. Because, like you said, they're all going to be back anyways.
Yeah, maybe that and, like, removing the microchips in his arms that call the suit or something. Because that's kind of like, that's like the ultimate symbol of insecurity.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think for me that's a minor nitpick. So yeah, you have anything else? Are you ready to move into final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm ready to just, I guess, talk about my overall thoughts of the movie. So for me, even though I know I'm in the minority with this being my favorite of the trilogy, I just find it the most enjoyable of them all. I mean, I think everybody, there's really not a whole lot of reason to talk about Iron Man 2. I feel like a lot of people kind of acknowledge the faults with it. I like it more than most, but even like I can still definitely see that it was kind of all over the place. I think the first two-thirds of Iron Man is perfect. I think it has kind of a lackluster finale, and it just kind of loses momentum as the movie goes on. I find that that happens in a lot of first installments. You know, most people are always a fan of the first installment, and like I find myself usually being a huge fan of the first two-thirds, and then it just, as we build to the climax, to me it does the opposite of what a movie's supposed to do, in which like it just slows down a little bit. And so for Iron Man 3, I feel like I'm fully engaged with the story and having fun beginning to end. It never loses me. There's never really any low points. And so just start to finish, I find myself enjoying it more than the other two.
Yeah, I think the climax in this film is definitely the strongest of the three. Yeah, for me, I think as action films go, as superhero films go, it's very entertaining. The action is all good. The characters are fun. It's never boring. I'm not sure how well it works as an MCU film. I think that's an issue with several of the one-offs, the solo films. But sometimes they just feel like placeholders. They don't actually affect the universe. And I think that's both a positive and a negative. The positive is it allows the director to just kind of go crazy and do whatever he wants. The negative is it is part of a series. And it is a little frustrating if a film's if the result of this film is not carried over to the next film. And I think it suffers from that a little bit. But just as an action film, as a 90s action flick directed by Shane Black, it's hilarious, it's exciting, it's fun. And I do kind of still, I love the film we got, but there's a part of me whenever I go back and watch the Iron Man 3 trailers that wishes we got that movie. And I understand this is the movie the director wanted to make, and I think he made it pretty well. But I kind of wish that he had that villain instead of Aldrich Killian. Yeah, but overall, it's just a good movie, and I don't think the Mandarin reveal is enough to dislike this movie. I understand if you like the comics. Well, no, I don't really, because I don't know the comics, but. It's for me, I don't think it thematically messes the film up or does any disservice to the film it's in. I think the comics and movies have to remain completely separate, or else they're not. I don't think they work if you try to constantly compare, because the comics have a million different versions of their own anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should allow the films to be the films and judge them based on their own successes and failures. And I think this film, as a film, is pretty much a success as far as what the director intended to do, which is to make a very fun, stylish action movie that calls back to 90s thrillers. So I hope you enjoyed that review. For next week, we will be reviewing my pick, which is Brian Hegland's, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, his 2001 film, A Knight's Tale, which I actually only saw recently, and I really liked it. I was surprised by how low the ratings were. So I'm really looking forward to talk about that one. Have you seen it before?
I have seen it. I've actually seen it several times. When I used to live just across the street from my cousins, and it was a movie that they loved, so they always had it on.
Yeah, I've only seen it once, but it feels like a film that could be really rewatchable. So I'm looking forward to seeing that one again.
I think for the first time in our show, this might be one of the ones where I'm slightly more negative than you are. I really like the movie, but maybe it's just because I have seen it so many times. but I may have a few more negative things to say about it. But overall, I actually like the movie a lot as well.
All right, I think we start wrapping up here. Again, if you enjoyed this podcast, please go and rate and review us on iTunes. It would help move us up in the rankings and help people find us easier. And if you want to contact us, we are on Facebook as Underrated Podcast. Feel free to comment on the page. We really love interacting with you on Facebook. We also have a website, underratedpodcast.com.
And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we are underrated_pod. So just tweet at us and, you know, we may read some tweets on an episode, and then you can email us at theunderratedpodcast@gmail.com. And I am also on Facebook as James Hamrick. So until next week, when we talk about A Knight's Tale, we will see you guys later.
See ya.
My ladies, and everybody else here not sitting on a cushion, today, you find yourselves equals. For you are all equally blessed, for I have the pride, the privilege, nay, the pleasure of introducing to you a knight sired by knights, a knight who can trace his lineage back beyond Charlemagne. I first met him atop a mountain near Jerusalem, praying to God, asking his forgiveness for the Saracen blood spilt by his sword. Next, he amazed me still further in Italy when he saved a fatherless beauty from the would-be ravishings of her dreadful Turkish uncle. In Greece, he spent a year in silence, just to better understand the sound of a whisper. And so, without further gilding the lily, and with no more ado, I give to you the seeker of serenity, the protector of Italian virginity, the enforcer of our Lord God, the one, the only, Sir Ulrich von Liechtenstein!